don't have quorum yet, but we're going to get started on some informal items that don't require that. Welcome and good morning, and those of you that were here late last night, I know I was. Hope you had your Pepsi and caffeine this morning. I'm wondering, Ms. Schill is here, and she has been kind enough to put together an update on the governor's budget for us and would like to do an overview.
Good morning, members. In your packets, you'll find two items. One is a spreadsheet entitled Governor's Revised Tax Revenue Budget, and the actual tax aids and credits part is on pages 3 through 6. What this provides is a comparison of the February 2015 forecast to the updated governor's requests. And in addition to the spreadsheet, so it looks like this, it's 6 pages. In addition to the spreadsheet, I've pulled out the items that are actually affecting this committee, and it looks like this. It's a small table. There are 3 items. We have changes impacting the homeowner PTR from the change item request to modernize railroad property tax, change item request home office deduction calculations. The second item is senior deferral reimbursement. The figures here are exactly what the governor proposed in January. And the third item where there is a slight impact is DOR, which is Department of Revenue Administration. There are 3 change items that have administrative impacts, and we'll be carrying those on the spreadsheet. So minor changes from the January governor's proposed items, and you'll find them here. I also copied for you the change item detail. And so if you have any questions, please let me know. But this spreadsheet is going to be the base spreadsheet that we make changes in the division report to.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Ms. Schill, again, the one sheet you were on is a subset of the larger one. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Any quick questions, members, before we move on? Thank you. Let's begin. Thank you for coming, Mr. Cummings. We have members before us. Items 3 and 4 on the agenda are bills that are not before us, but they are bills. They are department bills. The first of the two is the tax policy changes they would like to bring forward. The second is a tax technical provision bill that they would like to bring forward. Both these bills have been heard in the larger tax committee, and we're going to focus some attention on the property tax articles and related items in those bills this morning, and that's really where we're going to focus our attention. So thank you, Mr. Cummings. If you would introduce yourself for the record and get us going here on these two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Drazkowski and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to present and discuss the property tax articles of the 2015 Department of Revenue's policy and technical bills. Mr. Chair, I will be providing some opening remarks, and then our attorney, Kyle Gustafson, will be walking through the provisions of the policy and technical bills in the order of the bill and summary. Throughout the year, the Department of Revenue notices items in the tax code that could be clarified, updated, or corrected. These ideas are developed, edited, and improved throughout the interim. After development, they are drafted into bills and then begin to move through the legislative process. In order for this to work, it takes the hands of many. Other authors have stepped up to carry and hear various provisions within this package so they could be heard in the relevant committees. Thank you to Representative Davids, Drazkowski, Petersburg, Lesch, Torkelson, Loeffler, Loon, and Slocum for assisting in this effort. If the tax code is like a car, Mr. Chair, we like to think of the policy and technical bills as a tune-up or an oil change. Usually these bills are intended to make the car work better. These tune-ups are needed on a regular basis to ensure the tax code remains up to date and nimble. Many people tend to view the provisions in these bills as either policy, having a substantive impact, or technical, conforming to current practice, or a change with no impact. Yet many times it is not black and white, It is usually grayscale, somewhere in between. In preparing these bills, we need to make judgment calls as to which bill is most appropriate for each provision. If you would have selected another bill placement, we're open to the discussion of which bill this should be in. We prepare bills, two bills rather than one bill, in deference to past legislature's request. Mr. Chair and members, I would like to offer you all of our assistance to ensure that we have the opportunity to address issues in an appropriate way if they are brought forward. These are small but important provisions that will make the tax code better. So if issues come up, we appreciate the opportunity to work with you, Mr. Chair, and members to improve them. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to our attorney, Mr. Kyle Gustafson, within our department, who will walk through the property tax articles, and he'll be here as a resource to the committee. Again, thanks for the opportunity to present.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Members, we will call the meeting officially to order. We do have quorum, and Mr. Gustafson, we're going to start off with House File 1589. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, before he begins, would you like me to move the minutes?
If you would, that would be wonderful, Representative Erickson.
I will move the minutes of March 18th.
Thank you. Representative Erickson moves the minutes of March 18th, 2015 from this committee. Any discussion? Hearing or seeing none, all in favor of the approval of minutes from March 18th of 2015, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Kyle Gustafson. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. This morning I'll be beginning with House File 1589, the department's policy bill, and specifically I'll be covering Article 3, the property tax article in that bill. Starting with Section 1.
So, Mr. Gustafson, we're on page, help us out quickly.
This is
page 9. Page 9 of the bill.
That's, Mr. Chair, that is correct. Page 9 of the bill and page 2 of our summary.
Thank you.
Beginning with Section 1, this provision clarifies a certain property tax data on income-producing property, which is already defined as or classified as private or non-public when collected by local governments, will also be deemed to be private or non-public when collected by the state. Section 2, let me just, before I get into Section 2, the next set of provisions deal with air flight property tax, and these provisions clean up some of the definitions used in Chapter 270. Some of these provisions currently, as they're written, are circular definitions, so we're just trying to clean these up in the following sections. Beginning with Section 2, this section defines air commerce to include airline companies that make three or more flights in, out, or within the state during a calendar year. Section 3 adopts an industry standard term of maximum takeoff weight for excluding aircraft with a maximum takeoff weight of less than 3,000 pounds rather than the existing term of gross weight of less than 30,000 pounds, excuse me. Again, this is adopting a standard aviation term. Section 4 adopts a definition of person that is used in Chapter 270 to make the definition here consistent with the definition as it is used in other taxes administered by the department. Section 5 defines intermittent and irregularly timed flights to include departures or flights in which departures and arrivals are negotiated with the customer, including charter flights. Section 6 removes language referencing maximum takeoff weight as we're adopting, referencing gross weight because we are adopting the term maximum takeoff weight, as I mentioned, with respect to Section 3. Jumping ahead to Section 8, this section provides that if an airline company does not file its annual report with the commissioner, that the commissioner may file a report based on the information that is available and also may issue a notice of net tax capacity upon that information. Going back to Section 7 and then also Section 10, these sections clarify language that airline companies must file reports unless the commissioner determines that the company is exempt, and also provides that the commissioner may prescribe the content, format, and manner of air flight and railroad property tax reports and also adds cross-references to the definition of electronic signature. Section 9 adds a provision to allow the Board of State Board of Equalization to issue orders to county assessors to reassess all or part of a parcel in a county if the board determines that the property has been under or overvalued and the assessment is grossly unfair or inequitable. Section 11 eliminates a requirement that county boards of appeal and equalization file a printed or typewritten copy of their meeting minutes. This has no effect on those boards' requirement to keep the minutes. It simply provides that those boards are not required to send a paper copy to us. Section 12 provides that one of the criteria for combining nameplate capacity of wind energy conversion systems is whether the systems were constructed within the same 12-month period versus within the same calendar year. Section 13 moves the date for filing an annual report for wind energy conversion system from February 1st to January 15th. Section 14 allows the commissioner to grant an extension of time to file the wind energy production tax report for up to 15 days upon a showing of good cause. And I'll just note that sections 12, 13, and 14 bring the wind energy production tax provisions consistent with the solar energy production tax provisions that were enacted last year. Sections 15 and 16 require local assessors to enter construction and valuation data into county records as directed by the county assessor. Section 17 provides that if a county or city assessor fails to timely mail a valuation notice, that the assessor must mail an additional valuation notice and convene a supplemental local board of appeal and equalization meeting or other local review session. Section 18 provides a new subdivision stating that if a utility company does not file a report as required, the commissioner may file a report for the company and make valuations based on available information. It also provides an extension for filing such a report, or requires that an extension not exceed 15 days. Section 19 provides that utility and railroad company appeals to tax court must be filed within the time period prescribed in the tax court statutes, that being 60 days from the date of an order or 90 days if the court grants an extension. Section 20 makes various changes in how utilities and railroad companies may appeal the valuations, provides a timeline for filing an appeal and the review of such an appeal with the commissioner, and also provides and also specifies what information must be included in such an appeal. Section 21 provides that the commissioner may settle appeals of utility and railroad valuation assessments if it is in the best interest of the state. Section 22 clarifies that if a taxpayer files an administrative appeal, and this being a railroad or utility company taxpayer, and that taxpayer also files an appeal to tax court, that the administrative appeal will be dismissed and that the commissioner no longer will need to make a determination on the administrative appeal. Section 23 provides that county boards of appeal and equalization may not make a change in valuation that would benefit the property if an owner has denied an assessor access to that property. This brings the county board's review provision in conformity with the local board review provisions. Section 24 removes a requirement that towns or communities receiving taconite aid file a property tax levy report. Even if this body were to turn levy limits back on, these particular communities would not be subject to levy reports as they're currently not included in the definition of a local governmental unit subject to those limits. Section 25 clarifies that appeals of valuation notices may be filed in tax court prior to May 1st of the year in which taxes are payable, only if those valuation notices are sent by county assessors, and therefore that May 1st deadline does not apply to state assessed property. Section 26 provides that forest management plans required under the SFIA must be registered with the Department of Natural Resources. It also clarifies that if land is enrolled in various programs, that the entire parcel that contains those acres cannot be enrolled in the SFIA program. This section also clarifies that land classified as 2C managed forest lands cannot be enrolled in the SFIA program. This is a technical clarification because 2C land is already defined as land not enrolled in that program. Section 27 requires that upon request of the Commissioner of Revenue that the DNR must annually verify that claimants have current forest management plans on file with the DNR. Section 28 requires cities receiving aid to register an official email address with the Commissioner of Revenue. Section 29 and 30 deal with aquatic invasive species prevention aid, the first one requiring DNR to certify the number of watercraft launches and watercraft trailer parking spaces in each county to the Department of Revenue for purposes of calculating that aid.
Excuse me, Mr. Gustafson. Representative Erickson has a question.
Mr. Chair, I can wait till he finishes the
right.
article.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Sorry, Mr. Gustafson. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 30 requires the Commissioner of Natural Resources to certify to the Department of Revenue that the counties which have complied with the requirement to establish guidelines for addressing aquatic invasive species. Section 31 clarifies that the 5-day rescission period for sales made by contracts for deed does not apply to sales of tax forfeited land. Section 32 provides that if the commissioner cannot locate a taxpayer who would have been eligible for last year's supplemental agricultural credit by October 15th of 2016, or if the warrant issued for that credit is not cashed within that 2-year period, that the right to the credit lapses. I will note that in Article 4, the miscellaneous section, there is another provision related to the supplemental aid credit, which allows the commissioner to reissue an expired warrant if a recipient shows good cause or reasonable cause for not cashing that check. And Section 33, the repealer, eliminates an obsolete formula for calculating SFIA payments. These payments are now made on a flat $7 per acre rate, and therefore the formulas are no longer needed. And that concludes Article 4, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gustafson or Mr. Cummins, Section 26 on the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, what has been happening that has provoked this change, this technical change, that SFIA has to be registered with the Department of Natural Resources? Have we had a problem with this? Have we been, I'm not sure what could have been occurring out there, but obviously you're looking for some accountability, I would hope.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, he did a report on SFIA. He made a number of recommendations. We took some of them, especially the ones that were low cost or no cost. This was one of those provisions that we decided to put into this bill. I think one of the things that the legislative auditor found, especially as it related to the public expenditure related to sustainable forest dollars, is that a lot of times these forest management plans are required to be created, but they're not actually required to do anything else with them. Now, Mr. Chair, this and Representative Erickson, this is not, the registration does not mean that there would be some sort of an auditing process or anything at this point. There might be other reforms to SFIA that you may want to bring forward or think about, but this is just at a baseline to provide those registration of those with the DNR. But again, this is one of the things that was in response to the OLA report.
Was that one of his recommendations, Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, it was.
Okay, thank you. Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see that the effective date is not until July 1 of 2016. So does that mean there will be an educational process occurring during that time so that those enrolled will know and we can maybe straighten this out?
Mr. Cummins?
And I say straighten out based on the OLA report because we have had some issues. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And couple of things that caught my attention is, why are you asking for the authority to file reports on the part of different business entities? To me, it appears that if you've got an issue with some of these companies or entities in obtaining information, there are, in some of your statutes, as I'm aware, a failure to file penalties, but this to me seems to kind of kick out one of the legs of the stools of the process afforded taxpayers. It seems to me like you're trying to move quickly to just determining in your own mind what somebody owes and start the levy process.
Representative Hertaus, what section are you on?
Page 11.
Okay.
Section 8, that the commissioner can file reports on behalf of an airline, I think also on page 15. Reports of utility companies. Why don't you explain to us why you need this authority?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, under, you know, for other types of taxes, we have the ability to do what we call a commissioner filed return, and that is trying to ensure that that, you know, taxes are paid. Under this, we don't have an ability in the property tax system. You know, it's based on a levy, and so if you were not able to, you know, if you weren't filing, but there was a reasonable assumption at what your filing might be, then you would, you know, there is an expectation that you actually might be taken from the levy if you didn't file your reports timely, even though there may be enough information in order to know what the value of the property is. So in order to ensure that we there's equity amongst all taxpayers, this allows us to have an ability to put that information together in order to make sure that there's a reasonable assumption for the levy. Because you didn't file your you know, income statements on time doesn't mean that, you know, you shouldn't pay any part of the levy. And so this is just a clarification that we're trying to do that we think aligns with what we already have with commissioner filed returns. Mr. Chair, as it relates to some of our state assessed properties, a lot of times when we think of market value, we think of how much a property sold for. But as it relates to some of our state assessed properties, it is done by using other approaches like the cost approach or an income approach, in which determining their value is based on how much you know, income producing capability they have. And sometimes we know that information and are able to make reasonable assumptions about that. So that is just something that we're trying to clarify in this bill.
Representative Hertaus?
I'm not sure you clarified anything. Is this a problem with airlines and utility companies?
Mr. Cummings.
The reason why this was brought forward, Mr. Chair, is that we have seen instances in which people who are not submitting their we don't have enough clarity to be able to know what to do when taxpayers who do have this type of property but are not submitting their income reports in a timely way, how the Department of Revenue is supposed to deal with that. Are we supposed to exclude that property from the levy, or are we supposed to come up with a value that matches what we think it is, or based on historical performance? So we're just trying to clarify, how do we ensure that, you know, that known property is paying a reasonable share of the levy? Commissioner filed returns in other tax types. The intention is never to try and penalize them, but it is to try and come up with a reasonable assumption based on everything that we know in order to make sure that they're paying a share that is relative to what they should be paying.
So, Representative Hertaus?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, are you referring to personal property on the part of the utilities and or improvements on the property rather than the land?
Mr. Cummings, yeah, if you could give us kind of just a quick background, Mr. Cummings, so we know kind of more context here.
Mr. Chair, I believe that this, it depends on the type of property, and it depends on, you know, there are various exemptions for various parts of real and personal property. So as it relates to our state assessed property, which is what many of these deal with, there is an assessment based on what exemptions there are for real and personal property, depending on, again, for the air flight property tax, that there is real and personal property there. For utilities, there is real and personal property. For other tax types, most of the personal property may be exempt. But I don't know if that's helpful.
So Mr. Cummings, I'm trying to understand here too. So what you're doing is asking them to clarify their reporting of their property taxes paid on their income tax statements. Is that what we're doing here?
Well, Mr. Chair, when for certain types of properties that are state assessed properties, in order to come up with a market value, it's difficult to come up with a market value, and in some cases we're restricted from coming up with a market value that is based on comparable sales. In some cases we're directed to come up with a market value based on their income producing ability or their past performance on income. And so in that case, it is necessary for us to get information about their income producing capacity. And in the cases in which those reports of their income producing capacity is not completed in a timely way, then we need some ability to ensure that that everyone is paying the right share of the levy. And so this will allow us to just provide some clarity in terms of ensuring that we can make reasonable assumptions at the Department of Revenue based on everything that we know about what's going on with the company, even if they're not filing that on time.
Thank you. Representative Hertas, you good?
No.
Okay. Please follow up online with or offline with Mr. Cummings and members with all these. We've got a big article here, and we've got to keep moving. But Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. My question deals with the Section 30, a new language, another requirement for our counties to get a report into to the DNR. And I'm just wondering if we're going to be back here in 2017 with a bunch of counties saying they didn't see this requirement and got the report in late or didn't get it in. So who gets the notice out to the counties that this is another new report they have to get in and to be eligible for their AIS local levy money?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, part of the reason for this provision, Representative Anderson, is because when the provision was put into the tax bill last year, there wasn't any sort of helpful timeline for the Department of Revenue to go down to say reports need to be submitted by this date, certifications are done by this date, the checks are cut by this date. This is going to be helpful to just ensure there's a timeline that happens. We will absolutely be doing education with the counties to ensure that they know about the process. Really, and of course, we'd be willing to work with the committee or you, Representative Anderson. We just want to make sure that we just want to have some parameters for how we administer it. There was, with all due respect to what happened, there was sort of like a we're going to give out aid for aquatic invasive species. And it just goes out, and we want to be able to just put some fence posts around there to say, okay, so there's a report that's needed. When does that report come in by? Then we need to there needs to be a certification by when, and when do the checks go out? And we're just trying to put some guardrails around that. But we will work on education.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings, and I do appreciate you working to actually define some parameters around this. I've got a bill to repeal this. We ended up with a program here, members, where basically checks were mailed out to the counties, and many of them didn't even know what the checks were for. and I had counties in my district come to me and say, what is this check for? We got it from the Department of Revenue, and we don't know what it is. And of course, then as they dug into it, they realized it was based on the number of boat launches or boat ramps and parking stalls at those boat ramps. And so, of course, I suggested what they might want to do with the money is build more boat ramps. I mean, if I was entrepreneurial and in a county government. So this is government not working very well or properly. And, Mr. Cummings, I appreciate you trying to bring some sanity to something that didn't appear to have it to begin with. Other questions, members? Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry if this was asked already because I walked in late. But under Section 9, with the new language for the State Board of Equalization and determining whether or not a property is undervalued or overvalued, is there a definition somewhere of what grossly unfair is?
Hello. Please introduce yourself and thank you.
My name is Harriet Sims, and I am an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and chair, representative. There is no specific definition. That language was taken from another statute that defines the commissioner's authority to do the same thing, and that language has been in the statutes for a while, and rather than create different language for essentially the same power, we decided to use the language that was already in, I believe it is 270C94.
Representative Youakim. Thank you, Ms. Sims. Other questions, members? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and testifiers. Section 23, item number 8. Does that take away any authority that the county dash equalization board would have to make an adjustment?
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, representative, potentially yes. Currently there is no prohibition on county boards of equalization or appeal and equalization from reducing the value where the assessor has been denied access. This simply brings it, though, within consistency with the local boards of appeal and equalization. The idea behind this is that if someone does not allow an assessor to see any improvements that have been made within property or on the property, that the county board should not be would not be allowed to reduce the value without having good information about what the inside of property or a building looks like.
Representative Vogel?
Yes, Mr. Chair and testifier. So right now, you're saying that across the board that, or no pun intended, that all county boards or equalization boards have this and now it's just being done at a state level? Or is it indeed a state mandate on top of all equalization boards to change the way they do things?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't speak to what current practice is with county boards, if they are making changes when their assessor has been denied access to property. As I mentioned before, already local boards are not allowed to make these types of changes, but I would defer to county assessors and county boards as to whether or not in practice they're allowing any valuation reductions when the assessors have been denied access to review any improvements or the condition of property.
Representative Vogel? Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know we're moving through things, but I would like to have a little conversation on this because I'd hate to see the authority taken away from locally elected officials. Sometimes you do get contentious situations between an assessor and a property owner, and if this takes away their local discretion to use judgment when that happens, I'd have some issue with it. So, but we can discuss that if it's better.
Excellent. If you and Mr. Gustafson would do that offline, and that area of law could use some, maybe a little of your analysis. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Representative Whalen. Thank you. Other questions, members? Okay. Thank you both on this bill. And members, if you have any other questions or questions develop as you reread this that article, feel free. Mr. Cummings has been very available, and he'll connect you with Mr. Gustafson and or others in the department to help. This is part of our responsibility as a legislature to make certain that bills that are brought before us by these agencies and our ideas, our provisions that we actually as a legislature endorse, and they come in large chunks sometimes, so that's why we're here today. Thank you. Mr. Cummings and Mr. Gustafson, House File 1590, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. On House File 1590, this is the department's technical bill. This morning I'll be reviewing Article 4 related to property tax. Beginning with Sections 1, 3, and 4, these sections clarify that all transportation pipelines are subject to assessment and taxation without regard to the material that is transported through the pipeline. Section 2 removes a cross-reference to the lead hazard market value reduction. That was something that was repealed in 2013, and therefore this cross-reference is obsolete. Section 5 clarifies that certain provisions in related to local boards of appeal and equalization indeed pertain to local and not county boards of appeal and equalization. Section 6 extends the deadline from December 1st to February 1st for county boards of appeal and equalization to certify a trained member on their board in order to be eligible to hold their regular equalization meetings. Section 7 clarifies that taxing authorities only need to announce the time and place of their regularly scheduled meetings to discuss budget and levy issues, if indeed they have such a meeting. Section 8 modernizes language that deals with how taxing districts go about selling tax forfeited land. Section 9 clarifies that when a governmental subdivision already has property that are received for free under a condition of use deed and now wishes to purchase the land at market value, that before the department may issue a new state deed after the subdivision purchases the land, that governmental subdivision must first reconvey that land to the state prior to the new deed issuing. Sections 10 and 11 restore an exemption for personal property of an electrical generating facility that was inadvertently repealed last session. And Section 12, the repealer, has two provisions. The first one repeals a provision in the Green Acres statute that applied to enforcement actions related to compliance with agricultural, chemical, and water quality statutes that applied between the years 2009 through 2013, and therefore that provision is now obsolete. And the next provision repeals an obsolete statute that provided a one-year notice period for the expiration of redemption for properties that were bid in for the state through the tax forfeiture process prior to 1935. And that concludes Article 4. Thank you.
Questions, members? Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, when we heard these bills and poll taxes, which, of course, you serve on as well, actually, I don't think it was stated during those hearings that these are vehicle bills for the omnibus tax bill, but I know that Chair David stated yesterday when I asked if another bill was a vehicle bill that these two bills are vehicle bills for the omnibus tax bill. And so, you know, I'm wondering what your intent is to do with them in this committee. I guess, you know, if that's what they're really for. What's the plan for the property tax committee as it relates to that?
Thank you, Representative Lincheski. There is a possibility that some of these provisions will be included in the larger tax bill, potentially. And so our reason for being here today around this is to provide scrutiny in this committee of the property tax items and try to bring forward the best stuff we have here. And maybe leave the others behind. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that topic, what's the timeline going forward? When can the public expect to see the division report? What's your process at this point?
Yeah, we don't have a specific date yet, Representative Dabney, but we will be meeting more frequently when we get back the week after break, because we do have some more bills that we have to get through here. Sometime in either that week or the week after, we can expect to see the division report.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Cummings and Mr. Gustafson. Appreciate your efforts in being here today and your willingness to be a resource, Mr. Cummings, for our members around these items.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Is Representative Knobloch here? Representative Keel, are you here? Okay. Well, is there anybody here that's got a bill on our list? Representative Howe was here earlier. Well, maybe we need to dig back into the technical bill again, members. Okay, Representative Howe is here. We are in business. Thank you for coming, Representative Howe. And Representative Anderson will move House File 705 for possible inclusion. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 705 is a bill to alleviate some of the property tax implications to our veteran service organizations. And it's been amended to have a sunset in 10 years. The reason I brought this legislation up is that we have lost 10. We're losing VFWs and Legion posts at a rate of 10 a year. We've lost over 100 in the last 10 years. And this bill is not going to save them, but this bill, is, if we enact this, will give them a chance to raise their membership in the next 10 years in order to continue to exist. These organizations and these VFW posts and Legion posts and those types of organizations are valuable, viable. They're valuable organizations in our communities. They do a huge community outreach. They do they're big contributors and do a lot of charitable gambling, do a lot of charitable things. They donate to a lot of our organizations, and they are a meeting place. It's not so much that it's the veterans on their own, but it's what they bring to the community and what they're able to do for the community. I think they're not an end, but they're a means to the way of life that we've all come to know in those towns that have these organizations. We're battling here, I think, in the last few years, is it takes about 10 years for those old veterans like myself to realize that they want to get back and chum around with their old veteran buddies and they to join an organization. And I think that that's what this bill will do. It'll help them survive for the next 10 years before this comes, before this sunsets, and try to figure out a way to get their membership back up in these new veterans that we have from the Iraq and Afghan war to join those organizations. Chair Druskowski, if I could have my testifier here.
Thank you, Representative Howell. Yes, please come forward. Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Ralph Dene. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. Many of you have seen me at many of the other committee meetings here at the Capitol. Representative Howe took away part of my thunder, but I wanted you to understand that it's not about a place to go and have a beer like it was during World War II. our communities, many of them, as Representative Howe mentioned, do not have community centers at them. The local VFW or American Legion post, that's the community center. You want somewhere to hold a wedding dance? It's done at the Legion or the VFW. You need a place for the scouts to have a pancake breakfast to raise money? It's done at the local VFW or American Legion. And that list can go on and on. You know, the FFA, the Girl Scouts, there's just numerous organizations that the VFW and the Legions become their community center. And the biggest thing that I've come to understand that most of these that have gone under is they can't get the revenue to pay the property taxes. That's what's been driving them under. So most of the people that work and do things at the Legion and the VFW, they're volunteers. I've worked for years and years and years selling fish on Friday nights at the fish fries, and I get paid for it. I'm there for the community. And these people that come to the Legion are also people within the community who help run all of these other organizations, the Scouts, you know, for one, the Cub Scouts, the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, Cadets. There's just numerous ones that go on and on and on that we help represent. I'm on the board of directors for the North Star Boys Choir. It's a totally independent, you know, organization to take boys to travel around the world and represent Minnesota singing. So what I do is just typical of many of the members at the Legions and the VFWs in the state, and I would hope that you all support this bill. Any questions at this time, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Dene, and thank you and Representative Howe both for your service to our country. Members, questions? Representative Dabney, go ahead, and then we'll...
Mr. Chair, hopefully this is helpful, because I actually wanted to start with staff to explain the situation, because there's a little lack of clarity in my mind, because like the American Legion Club in my neighborhood, I think, wasn't the Legion founded in Minneapolis? I think so, the history piece, but they operate a bar. And so I'm trying to understand, kind of assume that the Legion property would be tax exempt anyways, but then they run a bar, so I'm wondering if Mr. Hines can help me understand how we tax that sort of a situation, because they're not the only Legion that runs a bar from my experience.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, usually on a situation where the Legion runs a bar, they would separate out the bar part of it and treat that as commercial industrial, and that would be separately, almost treated as a separate parcel versus the rest of the facility, which would receive this special classification that it does now for nonprofit organizations or not community service organizations.
Representative Dabney,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines, can you expand on what's the definition of community service organizations, whatever the proper term is here?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, you could also look at page 3 of the bill, which is the existing language, but real property up to a maximum of 3 acres of land owned and used by a nonprofit community service organization and not used for residential purposes. And then there's two different classifications within that. One is if they're not used for revenue-producing activity more than 6 days in a year, they get treated one way. If they're presumably doing revenue-raising activities for more than 6 days in a year, but they make charitable contributions equal to the amount of property tax they pay, then they get a different somewhat. Then they're subject to the state tax in addition to the local tax, but at a lower classification rate. So within this community service organization, there's still these two separate tiers, but all under the context of first you separate out a pure commercial activity like a bar and treat that separately.
Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hines. And then what would be the impact on other property classifications, I guess including other community service organizations, were the Howe bill to go into effect?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, it would be a shift then onto other types of property at the local level and a little bit at the state level, although it's not on the state commercial industrial tax, it's actually on the state seasonal recreational tax, which I could get into why that's the case if you want, but
please don't.
It would be a minor shift. It looks like there, and from the revenue department, the revenue analysis is sort of indicating about a $400,000 shift in taxes statewide. And I think that's an estimate that they don't have a lot of data on, so I think it's somewhat of a guesstimate. But
so, Mr. Hines, the state has their talons into both sides of them on this. Is that what you're telling us?
Perhaps.
They do.
So,
okay.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. I guess the challenge of this is, gentlemen, I appreciate your service to our country. I appreciate the Legion. The Legion in my neighborhood does many of the things the gentleman talked about. Would go there for fundraising events for various community organizations. One of the schools in the district needed to raise funds to keep their band program alive, and they threw a band concert at the local Legion. It was great. My daughter played VFW baseball last year. She's looking forward to playing VFW baseball again this year. So, you know, in the engagement in the life of the community that these service organizations provide. At the same time, a couple of weeks, I think I'm making omelets for the local high school baseball team fundraising event, but that's at the Eagles Club. And so how am I supposed to choose to increase the taxes on the Eagles Club in order to decrease the taxes on the Legion? Because that is what we're I mean, Representative Howe, you're choosing an activist government that picks winners and losers and says, Eagles, you're going to lose, but Legion, you're going to win. And I struggle with that. Can you help me?
Yeah, and I think our whole classification system does that, Representative Dabney, and so Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney. I guess I'm kind of questioning Mr. Hines, could you help me understand this fiscal note? Because what I see in the fiscal note, there's about $100 million worth of market value in that classification. I don't know where the $400 million shift comes when there's $100 million in the classification. I guess I'm a little confused on that.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, yes, $400,000. I said not $400 million.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney did ask a question that I had. However, you know, this is a catch-22, because the reason that our Legions, Auxiliaries, VFWs, Eagles, et cetera, have bars and restaurants is they needed revenue to pay their property taxes. So we're really caught in a dilemma. And then with this complicated classification system, you know, we have had to really watch our budgets in my units because I belong in Princeton. And we had to sell our Legion Club because we could not make it. So now we lease a little piece of property from the city so that we can have a place to meet, but no bar, no restaurant. But we have a nice kitchen.
Mr. Hines,
so this is a dilemma.
Mr. Hines can provide some good clarity here, too.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify something I said earlier. I may have, when I said that they automatically would carve out the restaurant or bar for commercial industrial, and reading the law a little more closely, I thought I had seen that, but it looks like the bar or restaurant could still qualify for the classification as long as it met that criteria of making charitable donations at least equal to the property taxes that it paid. So if they ran a bar, they made as much charitable contributions as their property tax bill, then that part would also qualify for that lower classification. But if it doesn't qualify under that basis, then that piece would be treated as commercial industrial.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney,
thank
quickly.
You. So I assume, Mr. Hines, that in-kind contributions qualify towards those charitable. So if the Legion or the Eagles, I guess only the Legion in this case, lets the high school baseball team use some of their space for a fundraiser and doesn't charge them, that would be attributable to the charitable donation requirements because it's an in-kind donation.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, I'm not I'm not sure that's the case. I'd have to look a little more closely to say that, because then you'd have to assign a value to that, and I'm not sure that's provided for, but it may well be.
Representative Hertaus.
Mr. Chair, just one last clarifying question.
Quickly, Representative.
So, Mr. Hines, if since the Legion operates a bar, and it would qualify for the property tax reduction under this bill, then the American Legion Club on 25th Street in Minneapolis gets a property tax cut for its bar, and the Hexagon Bar on 26th Street in Minneapolis gets a property tax increase. So government is choosing not only winners and losers between service clubs, but winners and losers between bars.
I think, Representative Davney, we have a classification system that's got about 55 or 70 winners and losers across a variety of areas.
Mr. Chair, that sounds Governor more Howe like is more like proposing making it more complicated.
Sounds like more of an argument than a question at this point.
I'm trying to understand what's the impact on my businesses in the area that compete in the same business, running a bar.
Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was kind of tracking down the same path as Representative Davney, and I'm pleased to hear that he's concerned about fairness. With regard to the testimony from Mr. Hines, am I hearing then that this is a unique situation where property owned by a Legion or VFW is got the ability to have two classifications on a single piece of property?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hertaus, there are many other circumstances where an assessor is allowed to split classify a property, so that's not unique to this circumstance.
Representative Hertaus?
Well, thank you. I guess I haven't encountered those circumstances, and I'm surprised to maybe be blinded by that. So the bar portion, most of these entities do have bars or income-producing portions. That's classified as commercial industrial property, and do they pay the state general levy?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, if they're classified as commercial industrial, yes, they would pay the state general levy. However, when I clarified that point, that if the bar was operating such that they were paying enough property or making contributions enough to offset or to equal to their property taxes, then they would fall under the other classification. Although even under that lower classification, they'd still pay the state general levy, but it would be the state seasonal rec levy rather than the state commercial industrial, which is half or approximately half that levy, that rate.
Okay, Representative Hertaus, you good? Quickly?
Yeah, my comment would be that we do have other legislation that would reduce the first tier of CI property and would offer relief to your organization in this circumstance. So that would be certainly a welcome estimate. And with regard to, you know, the tax capacity, if, for example, it was $400,000, the first tier that's been proposed is $150,000 exemption. So that would reduce the CI portion of the property tax by about a third.
Okay, last question, Representative Joachim.
I'll try to be quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have three entities in town. We're 2x2 miles in Hopkins. We have a VFW, an American Legion, and an Elks Club that are all owned. So this would affect two of our three. So the Elks Club, as Representative Davney is saying, is kind of going to be left out in the cold, and they're struggling as well. And our VFW is struggling right now because they're stuck on a street with major construction and lost some of their parking, and we're trying to adjust to help them. So I'm a little concerned about, like you said, picking winners and losers. My odd question is, when you clarified and said if a property is a revenue property like a bar and they're contributing as much as equal to their property taxes, then they can hit the lower classification rate?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, yes, if that's the case, then the bar is not classified as commercial industrial. It's classified under this special classification. And if it's a veterans chartered, it would get the break under the bill, a further break under the bill.
And
Representative Joachim.
With how they're struggling, and I hope this wouldn't happen, but in a way, if we end up lowering their property taxes, then there's a chance that they could be lowering their contributions then, too. So just a thought. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, members. Representative Howe, last 15 seconds here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I will tell you that the other thing that look at that, if they're trying to make their contributions to pay that property tax of last year, The problem is they're having a tough time with their membership creating that revenue. And if we can drop that property tax on them a little bit, they may be able to meet that standard and get into that separate classification. But currently, right now, they're all struggling. They're all struggling just to keep their head above water. And if we don't do something, you won't have American Legion, you won't have VFW to have any functions at, and there won't be any competition for the Eagles or the Elks because they just won't exist because we're losing them at a rate of 10 a year, folks, and that's the sad reality. So if we don't do something to help them exist, and remember, this sunsets in 10 years. I didn't put this in forever. I just want to give them a 10-year break to try and make it, because it takes about 10 years for us vets to figure out we actually want to rub elbows with each other. So that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Howell. Members, we got to keep moving here, but Mr. Hines, real quickly.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify one more point with regard to a question Representative Dabney raised earlier on reading about if part of their contributions can be allowing the facility to be used. I see that the stipulation is that they have to make contributions equal to previous year's property taxes and allow the property to be used for public and community events at no charge. So that would suggest to me that they could not count that kind of an in-kind contribution as part of their contributions.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Representative Joachim, real quickly.
Real quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. I remembered my other question. This is not going to help the VFWs or Legions that don't own the property that they are in, is it?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, the bill does refer to owned or operated, so I think the idea would be they would get the benefit there, too.
Thank you, Mr. Hines, and thank you.
Can I just quick ask? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, do we know what percentage of VFWs or American Legions aren't owned by? I would hope that we're helping. If we're going to do this, we're helping the majority of them.
We don't, Representative Joachim. With that, members, the chair lays the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Hall, and thank you, Mr. Dene. Representative Keel, House File 894. Good morning, Representative Keel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, members. Mr. Chair, well,
we will move it first. Representative
yes,
Whalen moves House File 228, excuse me, House File 894 for possible inclusion. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill that we hear every 2 years. It is in regard to border cities along the western edge of Minnesota, Breckenridge, Dilworth, East Grand Forks, Moorhead, and Ortonville are the cities included in this. And the $1 million in the request are to provide predictable and sustainable programs to retain and create jobs in these border communities. Sister cities right across the river. If you didn't know there was a river there, you wouldn't know the difference between the two communities, but we have some serious challenges with the competition between the two, and this has really helped be very effective. With me today thank you, Scott. I apologize. I knew his name, too. Mr. Scott Hutchins from Moorhead, and I would appreciate if you could hear from him.
Thank you, Representative Keel, and thank you for coming. Mr. Hutchins, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Scott Hutchins, Deputy City Manager, City of Moorhead. As Representative Keel noted, the status of Minnesota border cities on the northwest Minnesota border with North Dakota is particularly challenging given the competitive disparities that we face with our neighbor to the west. And this situation has not gotten any less critical with the advent of oil production and development in western North Dakota, and for the foreseeable future, a state having significant revenues to be directed toward a variety of purposes. Certainly the Border Cities program over the years has been very, very helpful and very successful, and has stemmed the tide of an outward exodus of business in our border communities to North Dakota. It has also helped us retain existing business and to compete for new business. The stability and sustainability that Representative Keel mentions and is the purpose of this bill is very critical. Just to give a brief overview of some of the activities in the border communities, Mr. David Murphy, who's the city administrator of East Grand Forks, in Representative Keel's district, apologizes for not being able to make it today, but if he were here, he would talk about the uses that East Grand Forks has made of the Border City Program and how important it has been to retain and attract business. He'd also note that with a repurposing of the North or the Grand Forks Air Force Base to a intensive drone-related activity area, he feels that East Grand Forks, with these Border City appropriations, would be in a certainly a much better position to compete with Grand Forks for business development that will come as that evolves at the Grand Forks Air Force Base. Dilworth, Minnesota, Representative Paul Marquardt. Dilworth used Border City credits most recently to secure a tremendous business. It's called Access Clinicals. There's information in your packet about it, and it takes a closed down big box facility and converted it into a pharmaceutical trial testing. And this is a company that looked throughout the region and selected the city of Dilworth, and did so because of the, in part, because of the availability of these credits. The city of Moorhead uses its credits not only to attract new business and compete with North Dakota and Fargo, West Fargo, and areas close to us, contiguous to us, but also to assist in business retention. It's all part of economic development, and it's all for the purpose of retaining business and jobs in Minnesota, in our community certainly, but in the state of Minnesota as well. The materials in your packet show some of the areas of competitive disadvantage and areas where we don't measure up as well as we would like in terms of our North Dakota counterparts, but yet we feel with the continued assistance, it has made a difference and will continue to make a difference for economic development in our communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchins. Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam was just showing me this back chart. I see you got Bloomington on there. But that wasn't my question. You know, and most of Bloomington's sales, by the way, aren't even taxable because we don't tax clothing in Minnesota. So that's just an interesting diagram. But I just want to thank Representative Keel and Assistant Manager Hutchins for being here. And I know Representative Lean has been a huge leader in this area, Mr. Chair, and both former Property Tax Chair Dabney and former Property Tax Chair Marquardt have passed this legislation into law in the past. For Representative Lean and others, at least maybe not in a permanent fashion because we had deficits and we had TELS targets to meet, but I know Representative Lean sure worked us over hard to try to get us to do that. So now, Mr. Chair, with a big surplus, my guess is you might have a chance to permanentize this money. However, I know there's been some objection from the new majority about auto spending in any category. So I'm sure you'll think that through as you put your report together. But I just want to say that this is an extremely important funding for these communities. Extremely important for these communities. You know, the testimony has highlighted, and all members should care, whether they're in the metro or rural, about these communities. I mean, they really have a competitive disadvantage, and Border Cities aid begins to reduce that disparity. It certainly doesn't go far enough. But I do want to thank Assistant Manager Hutchins for being here and Representative Lean for all his work on this for years, and I hope you look favorably on this legislation.
Thank you, Representative Lincheski. Other member questions? Representative Keel, thank you for helping address Representative Hertas has a question.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. We could really help most of Minnesota by just simply moving the state line to the Mississippi River.
Yes.
South Dakota line.
Yes, we could. Thank you, Representative Hertas. More proof of our large taxing state here we have. Representative Lean.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick comments about this program in general. And I think right now, at least when I call around to businesses in my district, some of the biggest benefits we can see from a program like this is not just the offsets from the tax competitiveness, but also the way we can use these dollars for actual economic development. I've heard of a lot of businesses have concerns about Minnesota, North Dakota, and the fact that with all the oil revenue right now, North Dakota is really able to do a lot through renaissance zones and economic development. And so in addition to some of the tax offsets, this bill really, or this program, I should say, really does go a long way to provide more of those economic development benefits for the border cities. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Members, I'm hearing bipartisan acknowledgement that we have too high of taxes here in Minnesota. Representative Keel, final words.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, this is a real challenge for Minnesotans in general, but really competitive with the North Dakota issues, and it especially makes me a little concerned when they talk about removing their property taxes entirely. I don't think they'll do that, but that could be really a big detriment to us if they were to choose to do that. But this bill really does help assist us and make our cities much more strengthen them. So, and with that, I would thank you all for your support.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Thank you, Mr. Hutchins. And Mr. Hutchins and I were talking yesterday, and I can only envision the smoking cops along the border there with North Dakota, $2.83 in Minnesota and 44 cents in North Dakota. I understand the smoking cops are coming, Mr. Hutchins. So
we'll be prepared.
You know, maybe you can give them a donut and a coffee. With that, members, we will lay the bill over. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Lewick is up next with House File 951. And Representative Vogel moves House File 951 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lewick, please introduce your bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 951 would correct a change that was made to assessor qualifications back here in the last legislative session, and it was brought to my attention by my folks in two counties that I represent that those changes were going to result in a significant new burden, which translates to higher property taxes at the local level. The other thing is it was going to actually create some huge inefficiencies and destroy some position descriptions and other things that have long stood to work well at these local levels. It particularly applies to rural counties. Full disclosure, I served two terms as a county commissioner, so there's two people you get to know real quick if you work in that arena, and that's the county engineer and the county assessor, because those two individuals touch the lives of the folks out there almost every day, although the assessor becomes very popular when tax statements come out. County engineer, when it snows, rains, or there's a bump in the road. But so this is really important that we take a look at this. We are complicating things at the local level for those counties. And I said I'm a little dated as a used to be county commissioner, so what I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is we'll get Mr. Johnson here that can testify to some of the things that this is going to cause if we don't correct it out there in rural Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. Mr. Johnson, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Johnson, the county administrator for Nobles County, very far southwest, and we're already feeling the impact of the 2013 legislation. We had two openings in our staff for our assessors and our small staff. And at January 1st, we got no qualified applications based on the certifications currently in place, so we had to go out and create a new job description for an entry level and give them 2 years to get to their CMA level. And as of last week, we have finally hired our first one. We'll start next week. So not only is it creating a challenge in costs, typically costs can be overcome, but it does increase the taxes. But we will have a very hard time filling positions, and we estimate that we will need 4 additional assessors over the current openings for our 19 jurisdictions that the locals currently handle with the townships.
So, Mr. Johnson, what I'm hearing you say is that the added requirements or the added threshold to become an assessor comes with a price tag.
It definitely comes with a price tag for Nobles County.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Is Mr. May here, Representative Lewick? And Mr. May, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the secretary for the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, and with me today is our 2015 president, Dan Whitman from Martin County. First of all, MAO is split on the 2013 legislation. We have members who are very much in favor of the accreditation that's required, because it'll increase professionalism and the work experience. We also have a part of our membership that feels the other way, and they feel that they don't need that kind of a designation in the areas that they assess, and they have some economic concerns, just like Mr. Johnson stated in his earlier presentation. The mission of MAO, of course, is very clear. The mission of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers is to provide education and information to promote excellence in property appraisal and assessment administration through professional development with the highest ethical standards. With that said, MAO fully supports education for assessors. In fact, in the last year, and Mr. Whitman will talk about this, MAO has reconfigured our education process to provide education for our members so that they can meet the requirements in 2019 as required by the 2013 legislation. The State Board of Assessors, which is a legislative body, oversees licensure and education requirements for all assessors in the state of Minnesota. They have a website that you can go to, and they have a link off the Department of Revenue's website that you can get there. And if you go there and look under the requirements, they have redone the requirements for all assessors for 2019 for all the different jurisdictions, and you can take a look at 2014 compared to 2019. There's also information on the website that talks about the 4 designations that we currently have: the Certified Minnesota Assessor, Certified Minnesota Assessment Specialist, the Accredited Minnesota Assessor, which would be the new required designation under the 2013 legislation, and the Senior Accredited Minnesota Assessor. And you can see the differences that that are required there. They also publish a newsletter that, in their January newsletter, they reminded assessors to be cognizant of the 2019 date so that they can get their work done and not all do it at the last minute, because that would cause problems for our association and our graders and our education system. But just for a little overview, currently in January 2015, for Certified Minnesota Assessor, we had 208 individuals in the state. For Certified Minnesota Assessor who have additional income requirements, so they're income qualified, there's 265. Certified Minnesota Assessment Specialist, there's 8. Certified Minnesota Assessment Specialists, excuse me, with income qualifications are 51. Accredited Minnesota Assessors, 66. And Senior Accredited Minnesota Assessors, there's 251. So that's a total of 849 licensed assessors under the State Board of Assessors. With that, I would turn it over to Mr. Whitman with just the requirement that MAO has. What we really need for our association is a definitive answer on this issue so that we can provide education to meet whatever designation guidelines are effective for 2019. We need that to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. May. Mr. May, quickly, just real quickly, characterize, if you will, where the assessors are located geographically or in support of the current law versus maybe a change. Quickly.
Very quickly. I'm not sure it's geographic. We have people in the metro area very much in favor of the 2013 legislation. We have people out state Minnesota that are very much in favor.
So it's a mix.
It's a mix, and okay. I think Dan can thank talk you. About that more. It's a mix.
Thank you. Mr. Whitman.
Yeah,
welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Whitman. I am the Martin County Assessor and also this year's president of the Minnesota Assessing Officers Organization. Mr. Mate pretty much laid everything out, you know, that I would say. We are concerned. We are very much in favor of continuing education, and but as an organization, we are not able to take a position just because of the wide differences in support. And I would say not only is it geographically spread throughout the state, but even the reasons that we are in favor or against or you know, struggle with the legislation vary greatly too. It's some it's financial and some of it's just people that didn't feel that in some of the less complex areas that they needed the additional income training and whatnot. So it's a big difference throughout the state. But it definitely does need to be decided. We, I guess from MAO's position, we have totally rebuilt our education department in the last 2 years. And we have also made a very significant change in our budget to move forward to make us able to meet the requirements that are going to be demanded to place it, to get everyone in the state to the accredited level. I've heard huge concern from our educators and our licensors and our interviewers and graders that right now, as I'm told, we need to interview or grade 19 appraisals, form reports per month to get to the level we need by 2019. Over the last several months, they've only done four. So what's happening is people are ramping up, but every time there's a word of potential changes in the rules and the laws, they delay getting this done. So all of a sudden, the worry is that people are going to wait for another year or two, and then in the last 2 years, there's going to be no possible way to grade and interview and get people to the level of licensure they need to be. So we need to have a rule in place, definitive, and you know that's what we're feeling the biggest need now. We can live with what the rules are. We just need to know what the rules are.
Thank you, Mr. Whitman. Is there another testifier that wishes to speak? Or Mr. Baker, if you'd...
Yeah, we do have Mr. Baker and Mr. Atkins.
Because we do have a couple of bills left, it'd be nice to keep things moving, and I believe there is a question from Representative Anderson while you're getting situated.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm hearing the same things in my counties and townships. What this legislation, I think, has done is eventually do away with our local township assessors. They're at the age and the expertise level they evidently don't want to continue on with this higher level of certification, and that's going to increase the cost as we move to more at the county level. And I would favor this bill to somewhat lessen these certifications for our local township assessors.
Thank you, Representative Anders. Representative.
Mr. Lewicki. Chair, and maybe if I could just take about a minute here, I know you're pressed for time, but I just want to make sure we understand what the previous legislation did. And I'm speaking to the two counties that I represent. I'll give you one example: 37,000 parcels in the county that have to go through the process of being assessed every 4 years, but basically it's a constant thing. Less than 10% of those properties are commercial classified properties. We have six field assessors in that particular county. Two of them are accredited, the level that we would like everybody out there to go to instantly. The other four are certified. So why would, my counties are saying, excuse me, why do I have to make all six of those folks credit them at the AMA level when only a small percentage of the work I have out there deals with commercial property. And so you understand, that means we get rid of long-standing job descriptions and that pay grade within that within those local counties. I want to make clear, this bill also says right up front, you don't get to assess or appraise property for tax purposes unless you're qualified. So this does not in any way lessen the requirements to be qualified. But and I think it's telling that within the Assessors Association here, they can't reach a clear, definitive, we're really in favor or against this. We have created havoc out there in rural Minnesota within our assessor departments, and we need to fix that because it's all going to come down to a lot of qualified people that are close to retirement saying, this is, I'm over, I'm out of here. And we're going to lose that skill set, and we're going to cause a huge amount of additional property taxes because we didn't pay attention to what we were doing here in St. Paul. So I just want to get that out of the way in case we just have a two-word closing comment.
Thank you. I believe Representative Daphne has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to provide a little historical background as to why the 2013 law passed. There's real problems across the state with havoc, not amongst county employees, but amongst property taxpayers. And that was because of inconsistent assessing practices across the state. We had instances where people came forward who owned a parcel of property that crossed a county line, and they were assessed one way in one county and a different way in another county. This bill takes us back to that. It's prioritizing simplicity for county commissioners over tax assessment quality and fairness and consistency for property taxpayers. The proposal coming into the committee, the conference committee in 2013, was to eliminate the Board of Assessors, because the Board of Assessors had not been doing their job at overseeing assessors and dealing with discipline issues on assessors who were not acting in a fully professional manner. Earlier this year, this committee heard ongoing concerns over inconsistent assessing practices. The 2013 change was an attempt to get to that, to set a level of professionalism for assessors, but also to maintain the Board of Assessors as the professional organization that oversaw assessors and their practices in the state, rather than eliminate that and have those powers go to the Commissioner of Revenue. I think we can ask ourselves what priority we put on consistent assessing practices across the state and qualified professional assessors with this bill. And I'm troubled by it. Thank you.
And Representative Lucheski, you had a question? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And, you know, the property tax is the one tax where the government sets the base on which you will be taxed on. So the assessor holds the key with property taxes. And I think reducing the quality is the wrong direction to go. And, you know, earlier this year we heard a number of people from farmers come in and talk about the inconsistencies in all those type of things when it deals with assessment. And I don't know why, as Representative Dabney said, we'd want to go back to the way it was. And I guess if it's a matter of finding people or a matter of costs, then maybe the state has to step up and provide some costs for these counties. Because I live in rural Minnesota, I shouldn't have less quality assessors because either we can't find them or whatever. Like I said, this is the one tax where the government, the assessor, sets the base on which we are taxed. And so if it's a problem out in rural Minnesota, then with a $1.9 billion surplus, let's provide some funding so these counties then can hire and find these assessors. But I don't think lowering the quality when anyone who's been on the property tax division for years, every single year you hear about assessors and inaccuracies and unfairness and inequities and all these type of things. So let's not lessen what we've done here. If anything else, let's find a way in which we can either provide the funding to get people out in rural Minnesota that have the qualifications. So I think we're moving in the wrong direction on this bill.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the two previous comments. And I'm going to assert that you certainly, neither of you, intended to insult the hardworking assessors, field assessors out there in rural Minnesota, because despite what you may think, if you live it year after year at the local level, yes, there's certainly disagreements on property tax market value. There's a process that's dealt with, but again, I really am somewhat discouraged of the language that I just heard that basically said those assessor offices out there in my two counties in my district don't know what they're doing, and we're not lowering the standards. That's one of the four. The certified versus the accredited are legitimate licensures out there. So, I mean, I really think that we need to get back to the focus here and not impede the integrity of hardworking county employees, union members that are doing a good job out there. There's always that issue with the employee that isn't doing things quite right. But this is not about that. And it's certainly not about lowering standards. That first sentence in my proposed change says you will be qualified to appraise the value based on the class of property. I want to make that clear, and I don't want to get this into a discussion over what should be how we do our personnel management within the county and what we do with employees that may not toe the mark in any area. This is about simply fixing something that is causing a lot of problem out there already, a lot of money with folks that are doing the proper job. So, thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative. I didn't hear that. I didn't hear anyone getting impugned. So, you know, I can tell you, and we don't know each other, but the legislators who just spoke have incredible respect and commitment and acknowledgement for those employees for the great job they're doing and the hard work that they're, you know, being asked to do. But I will say I do think this is lowering standards. I mean, one way I think about it, you know, so Representative Pinto's an attorney. You know, we wouldn't let some attorneys pass the bar and not others. They couldn't be licensed in the state to practice. You know, so if we're going to have a standard, whether it's high or low, everyone should have to meet it. And I think what concerns me is this isn't about, when we looked at this in the past, about going after anyone in particular, but there was a study done. And I can't remember the years. I was trying to get Mr. Hines, maybe he can tell me, where we did a study to find out, you know, what's the track record here, and it's abysmal. it's not good. And so, unfortunately, for folks who do live in Greater Minnesota, with some exceptions, we have a law, Mr. Chair, that says you have to come in at assessing values with, I think it's within, either you can be 5% below the value of the sale is, or 5% above. I think it's 95% or 105. I could have that wrong. It could be 90 and 110. But you have to hit your mark. You can't go around and say properties that are, you can't overvalue them to collect more revenue. You can't undervalue them because, you know, you feel a certain way. And these folks who are doing this across the state are doing the best they can, no doubt. They're great people. But the facts remain that in the value studies that were done to kind of check the box, you know, how did assessments line up with sales? Greater Minnesota didn't do too well. I mean, the metro sales lined up pretty well, and part of that is because there are more same and similar sales. But the track record was one that, if you look at it from the taxpayer's perspective, was really would have been, you know, in my estimation, really, you know, abrogating your authority as a legislator to not address the results of that study. I mean, if you weren't going to take any action, if you could see the items that we're looking at, you were saying an incredibly unfair process or unfair outcome was okay. And so, you know, I guess, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Hines can recall for me, you know, the study, I can't remember if it was the legislative auditor or if it was the Department of Revenue or, you know, how, you know, there was a lot of work done before people looked at changing or raising the standard for everyone.
Mr. Hines, if you could quickly clarify.
Mr. Chair, I can't remember the exact study that Representative Lanchesky is referring to. I see Mr. Klockstein from the department is here. Perhaps he would know. But I mean, they do a study every year of the sales ratio study and the State Board of Equalization and the issue state board. So that's sort of an ongoing basis, but I can't remember a specific year of a more intense study.
Representative
Lanchesky. And I won't belabor it. I know you have stuff to get through, and I know Mr. May is here as well. We heard from him. You know, he's the head of the whole state situation, and he also, you know, was asked under a former Republican chair, actually, to bring information forward and walk through the data with the committee, and it was quite revealing what the inconsistencies are around the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have Daphne, Marquardt, and Simonson, and if we could, you know, quickly address this and then move on to the content of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to register that my comments were mischaracterized. I said nothing that impugned the motives or the actions of assessors. In fact, the work in the 2013 conference committee was to reaffirm the professionalism of assessors and maintain the Board of Assessors as the professional board that oversaw, trained, and disciplined when needed assessors. But the option was the elimination of that board and the degradation of that profession. And I think asking assessors to be qualified in the work they do, professional in the work they do, have authority for their profession, and more importantly, have consistent assessing practices across the state so that our property taxpayers are treated fairly and accurately was a greater value. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lewick, you and I just differ on this bill, is that I put the fairness and equity of our property taxpayers over the convenience of government bureaucrats, and you do just the opposite. And if you think the assessment process is working perfectly, please come out to my district and talk with farmers and then tell them how, no, what you're saying isn't right. The assessors are doing perfect. You come out here and tell me that. So, number one, I think assessors do a wonderful job, but your bill is putting the convenience of government bureaucrats over the high-quality assessments we need that provide fairness and equity to our property taxpayers.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just defer until after we're done with testimony.
Thank you, and because we are pushed on time, if the testifiers could keep it within about a minute, and as this would be Mr. Atchison, if you could state your name and affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Atchison, Hennepin County Assessor. Hennepin County opposes House File 951. We request that you hold the current law and requirements for accreditation as in statute. Not to redo all the other comments that have been read before and get specifically into the bill, is that it indicates that the Board of Commissioners, with a consultation with the assessor, would set the qualifications, and that would be true if you were in a true county assessment. In Hennepin County, we have 13 different assessing offices, the county being one of those, and the county board would really only have power over the county assessor's office and not the other 12. So you would, even within one county, would have 13 different ways to have assessment quality just based on the designations. Thank you.
And thank you. Mr. Klockstein.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Klockstein, for the record. I'm the Assistant Director at the Property Tax Division for the Minnesota Revenue. This is an important hearing Assessor accreditation is the key to ensuring Minnesotans, no matter where they live, have assessment laws applied to them fairly and appropriately. The intent of the law was to ensure consistent assessment practices statewide and develop a pool of assessors to act as county assessor in cases of retirement or attrition. We know that the property tax system has become more layered over the years, not less so. We have an expanding number of property tax classifications and a multi-step agricultural homestead process and various special valuation programs that have made assessments more complicated. Having well-trained and educated assessors who share a common language helps achieve consistency in administering the property tax. In closing, we have shared your concerns over the years related to assessment quality, and we firmly believe that the accreditation law passed in 2013 is an important step to addressing these concerns for many reasons. Thank you.
And thank you. Are there any other testifiers? Members of the audience? Seeing none, I will return to Representative Simonson. There's a pass. Any additional? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To revenue, did you receive a lot of calls after this law was enacted? Because I got the sense in my counties that they were seeking clarification from the Department of Revenue. And then when they came out to assess our properties, some owners were questioning, and they were saying, well, it's revenue's fault. So could you comment on that?
Mr. Clarkson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there was a lot of discussion prior to the enactment of the law. Once the law was enacted, I think the assessors understood what it meant.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, House File 951 will be laid over for possible inclusion. And next is House File 995. Representative Rarick, and while you're coming down, I will move House File 995 be heard and then held over for possible inclusion. Please proceed, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 995 is property tax relief basically for counties in regards to the Indian Child Welfare Act, a federal program.
Mr. Chair, may I move this bill for possible inclusion?
Thank you, Representative Erickson. I had already done that as the representative walked
you.
Down.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Representative Rarick.
What is involved with the Indian Child Welfare Act is in child placement cases, tribal courts are given jurisdiction over county courts so that the children can be placed in tribal homes that are more appropriate for the upbringing of the children. Those costs are mandated then to be covered, and the federal government only covers a portion of those costs. The remainder is put onto the counties. And because we have some counties in the state that have much higher tribal populations, they then incur a much higher rate of having to pay for this than many others in the state. So what we're looking at with this bill is to have the state take over that so it's spread out proportionately. And in the case of one of my counties, Pine County, the costs for them in 2014 was $350,000. So it's for small counties that don't have a lot of revenue, this is a very large expense that they have to cover.
Thank you, Representative. And if anyone is wishing to testify, if you could come down and approach. But Representative Erickson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I have a comment to add to Representative Rarick's amount. In Mille Lacs County in 2014, $1,421,352 spent on tribal placement. That's costing a poor county a ton of money.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any addition? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rarick, one, two, hold on, three, four, five, six. I'm confused. Why are you here? Six times in your short bill, you refer to the Commissioner of Human Services. And what I'm sensitive to is this looks like human services expenses, not tax expenses. So why aren't you in front of the Human Services Committee saying counties are experiencing this human services cost burden, and human services, you should then step up and pay for this human services activity rather than taxes?
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I have been in front of HHS reform already. Mm-hmm. I believe we were sent here because ultimately this is property tax relief for counties. That's why we're here presenting that to this committee. But I believe funding would be coming through HHS.
Let's check that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I mean, this does go to the soul of my questions. I understand why you're here, given the structure of the bill. Mine was a bigger, why are you here? Who will carry the cost of this? Will this be carried in on the tax spreadsheet or Health and Human Services?
I think I'll go to Kathy Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, the way the bill is structured, it's seeking local aid to make these payments, and you have a revenue estimate that identifies what the local aid payment would be in total. I have requested a fiscal note on this bill. I still have not received it, and I will be honest, the request was just a couple of days ago. So I anticipate on getting that fiscal note sometime early next week. But identified in the fiscal note request is the impact to HHS, Department of Corrections, and any administrative cost that would be in Department of Revenue. So that is the information that we have at this time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. And you know, Representative Rarick, as I said, I know why you're here because of the way the bill's written. I just question when this is a Health and Human Services activity. I've got no question that it's a cost challenge to counties, that some resolution is a reasonable conversation at a minimum to have. What does this have to do with the cut to Health and Human Services funding that your caucus proposed yesterday? Is that why you're looking at taxes, because of your proposed cut to Health and Human Services funding?
Representative Rarick.
No, don't.
For clarification, Representative Dabney, I believe that this bill started and progressed before the author and many of us here knew what targets might be. So, but I'll still refer to. We do have Representative Knobloch could maybe enlighten us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, as you see, this bill was first authored in February. In fact, this is the first time I've actually seen this bill or been aware of it, and I certainly can assure you that it has nothing to do with the Health and Human Service targets that were set up. I wasn't aware of this bill. Obviously, it's a bill that I suppose could be structured to have money from the Department of Health and Human Services, or it could be structured as county aid relief as it is structured. But that's apparently the choice that Representative Rarick has made. I don't know all the details of the particular county instance here, but this has got nothing to do with why we chose the Health and Human Service targets that were chosen.
Now, Mr. Chair, one last question for the office.
Representative Dabney.
Without giving up that last point, the concern is we've got vulnerable children here, and the general trend in child welfare is, if at all possible, let's keep the kid in the home and work with the family, because it's a better outcome for everybody. I'm concerned that your bill, by fully funding from the state the cost of out-of-home placement, while the counties would still carry costs to in-home services, that what we're going to do is break up Indian families, because the county will say, no cost to us if we place the kid out of the house, rather than do intensive services in the house with the family, we'll just place them out.
Representative Brewer, if you had a response.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this bill is only going to be concerned with the cases that the tribal courts place the children outside of the home. I was just speaking with the Assistant Commissioner. Any cases that deal through the county courts, the county will be responsible for those costs.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for clarification, this was an idea brought forth by the Association of Minnesota Counties. This was part of their 2015 legislative agenda, and they're responding to counties, you know, that are bringing requests to them. And so they put this in their legislative platform, and I think that's why Representative Rarick is carrying it. And I, too, am a co-author. So.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any further questions? Seeing none, House File 995 will be held over for possible inclusion. And we are over time.
We do not.
Up to you.
Okay. We will, Representative Erickson, if you wanted to.
Mr. Chair, I will move House File 228 to be considered for inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for staying over late to hear this bill. I think it will go fairly quickly. Members, currently scholarships and fellowship grants to students attending college are not taxable for federal income tax purposes. Scholarship and fellowship grants are not taxable for state income tax purposes. However, in determining the renter's credit that a student who has a scholarship or fellowship grant gets, the scholarship or fellowship grant is taxable or considered as part of their income in determining their renter's property tax refund. And I have a letter I could read from a student that was affected by this. I think I'll pass on that, but it was an example of someone who's going to law school here in Minnesota. Had a scholarship, filed for the renter's property tax refund, and then got a notice that they owed $800 back from the state. And I guess I just think that we should be consistent, and that if we've got students that have worked hard and been able to get scholarships or earn fellowship grants, you know, there's enough student debt out there already. They should not be penalized when they're getting their renter's property tax refund, and this bill would change the law so that they no longer would be.
Well, thank you, Representative Knobloch. Because of interest of time, anyone in the audience interested in testifying, please approach the front. Representative Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Knobloch. You know, I understand, and we've heard this bill, you know, kind of every couple years, and it seems like a good idea until the definition of income for purposes of receiving the refund is described. And, you know, we don't, for purposes of a property tax refund, we're not just looking at federal income. We're looking at all your sources of income to you, because the property tax refund, also known as the circuit breaker, and the renter's credit are our attempt to give property tax relief to you based on your ability to pay. So if you have an income source, it's counted, even though it may not be wages, for example. So if I may, Mr. Chair, could Mr. Hines remind the committee what sort of things we count to find out what your income is to you to determine if you should receive a refund? What is the base for that?
Ms. Nina.
Or Ms. Manzi, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, the statute reads that it's all income that's not specifically excluded in this definition that's called household income. I have the instructions for the property tax refund here with me, and some common examples that they list in the instructions are employer-paid adoption expenses, distributions from Roth or traditional IRAs not included in adjusted gross income, workers' compensation benefits, contributions to a dependent care account or medical expense account, non-taxable employee transit and parking expenses, veterans benefits, non-taxable scholarships, fellowships, and grants for education and tuition waivers or reductions, non-taxable pensions or annuity payments, federally non-taxed interest in mutual fund dividends, a reduction in rent for caretaking responsibilities, housing allowances for military or clergy, non-taxable military earned income such as combat pay, and there are a few others listed. So it's a fairly broad definition of income that's intended to measure the individual's ability to pay property taxes, whether it's homestead property taxes or property taxes paid through their rent.
Quickly, Representative Lynch, okay. Is there Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I want to thank Representative Knobloch for bringing this forward. I know it does complicate matters, but when you made that list of, when you gave out that extensive list, a lot of those, there's a few of those items that that money can't be used for anything but that. So like a scholarship can only be used to pay your, pay for college, not to pay your property tax. There were other things that you could use that money that you're getting, and I can understand why that's considered an income. But I have a hard time when we're, it kind of feels like we're penalizing kids for working hard and getting a scholarship, even though I know it does kind of throw a wrench into things that I'd be interested, I would be interested to see a fiscal note on it.
Mr. Chair, there is a revenue estimate, and the cost is about $1.4 million a year, so it's not a particularly expensive provision.
I believe that the next committee is eagerly anticipating utilizing this room. Are there any further urgent questions? Then Representative Erickson renews her motion that House File 228 be held over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative. And this committee is now adjourned.